This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nelly. Our guest this week is Ben Kruger, the Senior Vice President for Renewables at Raceline Alternative Energy. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Ben Kruger next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net, providing individualized protection on more than 530 million acres of farmland. Crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. A new generation of the world's population is demonstrating a willingness to invest in practices that improve the health of the globe. Ben Kruger, Senior Vice President of Raceline Renewables, says there is opportunity for U.S. farmers to help preserve the environment.
I think what's changing is there are certain parts of the world and there are certain parts of the United States where people would place a value. There's a belief around and a value for improving air quality, or there's a belief and value around seeing the benefit to soil quality or water quality, things like our river systems, which today we've got a lot of topsoil that's washed into rivers and created dead zones in the Gulf. And I think people realize that there is an opportunity cost to society, that if we look at the opportunity of bringing back some things that were here long ago, there can be value and benefit in terms of the health and well-being of society, and also help us improve the efficiency and the yields of crops if done the right way.
So, is this a society and is this a business climate where people are willing to spend money toward a smaller carbon footprint and practices that are better for the environment?
Yeah, it really is, Jeff. There's a lot of emerging voluntary demand. I would call it voluntary, where people on their own accord are willing to pay that extra premium for their airline ticket or pay an extra premium for energy in their home that was produced from renewable resources. It's growing at a rate that is high single digits to low double digits, depending on where you're at in this country or in the world. So there is that market, and I think we expect that market to continue to grow at that rate for quite some time into the future.
Let's talk about U.S. energy policy and compare that to the energy policy of the rest of the world. Are we in the lead, or is the U.S. in need of a solid directive for what it's going to use for transportation fuels?
I think it probably defines, it depends on how you would define leadership. What I would say is the United States was really pioneering in certain respects with our current renewable fuel standard, which was launched in 2007 under the Energy Independence and Security Act during the second Bush administration. And in launching that, there was a view not only for the benefit around sustainable fuels, but it was as much around energy security and investing in rural economies. And in doing that, could actually help farmers have more options for more markets that can protect our food system, and that that additional income could come in and help smooth out some of the cycles that often happen in agriculture, and really make us more energy secure and more food secure. So we took a leadership position that in 2007. I think other parts of the world have since followed, and in some cases maybe other parts of the world are now moving a bit faster than we are. But in terms of the U.S. as part of an all of the above energy approach and strategy, I think I am really proud to see what we've done with policy, and even our current administration has made some strong statements around how we want to have a strong farm economy and have a strong position in biofuels, because the two really have a lot of value for the country in a lot of different ways.
Ben, how organized is the domestic maritime industry, and how well organized is the global maritime industry?
Well, it's getting more organized. Maybe I'll start with the second piece, which is to talk about maritime from a global perspective. So all shipping that happens in the world, for the most part, is governed by an organization called the International Maritime Organization, or the IMO. And this is an organization that has 175 different countries as members, so it's basically the whole world. And it comes together on a regular basis to review end-to-end all things that happen in shipping, for whether it would be the safety of ships, whether it would be technology improvements that can be made to lower costs, whether it would be the size of the ships and other infrastructure needed to support efficient movement of goods and commerce. But also it's very focused on the energy required to move shipping, as well as the emissions profile and the sustainability in it. So I would say very organized globally. And then if you disaggregate that into other countries, in this country there are other country level groups that connect to the IMO and then help drive some consistency and approach domestically as well.
So when we talk about the maritime industry globally, that's made up of a lot of different flags of a lot of different countries. What percentage of that are U.S. vessels, and what percentage of that falls perhaps in Asia or other flags?
It is very diverse, Jeff. In fact, roughly 85% of all the ships on the water today are actually not U.S. flag vessels. So the U.S. has flag vessels and some market share, but it's very diverse after that, and would probably kind of follow some of the traditional sizes of countries, where China's got a big presence and European countries have a big presence, other parts of Asia, spots in South America, but very, very diverse construct.
October is a big month with regard to the maritime industry, and there is a decision that is pending. What's the basis for the decision, and what could be a conclusion that could open the door for additional biofuels?
Yeah, so in a couple of weeks, the International Maritime Organization will meet, and they will vote on whether they want to proceed with putting in what they call a net zero framework for global shipping emissions by 2050. So this vote, this comes on the back of many years worth of discussions. Now, the IMO as an organization, its members have agreed that there's an opportunity to improve the emissions profile of shipping, but also improve the energy usage and find ways to drive efficiency and lower costs in shipping. And so this vote that's coming up, there was a preliminary vote in March where this framework was passed, and now the final vote is what was expected to take place. And if it's passed, it would put in a phased global fuel standard with a carbon pricing mechanism that will incentivize ships to drive down their emissions in a variety of different ways, starting as soon as calendar year 2027.
So how would this impact the use of renewable energy in those vessels? And where would be targeted areas where that supply would be used?
We think it's going to have a really positive impact for renewable fuels. In fact, by certain estimates, we think the demand for renewable fuels in the maritime sector could be as high as 25 million metric tons around the world by 2030, and represent as much as a third of all of the biofuel demand globally. What gets probably more interesting for this audience in terms of how that can impact our economy in the United States is there's a variety of ways that you can meet the expectations of the IMO if it passes. The two lead horses, we think, in that race would be biodiesel, which can be produced from either waste as well as oilseed crops, or bio-LNG, which is renewable natural gas that's liquefied, which in large part can and does come from agricultural waste and residues. So we think a really big amount of that demand can come from those areas. And when we even break it down even further and we say, what could it mean for the United States? with certain assumptions, you could see markets that more than cover some of the lost revenue that we're seeing right now with China soybean exports going to Brazil. And more than cover, it probably could also create demand that, just in biodiesel that could be two or three times the size of the Iowa soybean crop. So it's a really big deal. It has the potential to drive billions of new revenues for rural economies if we get it right and if the vote passes.
Well, just because the international group makes a decision to go in this direction with renewable fuels, that's not a slam dunk guarantee that the U.S. will be able to supply that market. Assuming that vote takes place, what work within the U.S. from the regulatory standpoint or the legislative standpoint would have to take place in order for the U.S. to gain market share?
Yeah, I would go through a few things. I'll speak to them and then define it. One, we need to start with just more awareness and education. Second, there are some additional incentives, which we think will be needed to make sure that we're the most competitive fueling point. Third, there's some pieces around infrastructure, short and long term, as well as the carbon accounting pieces that got to get sorted out. So let me just step through briefly each one of those and provide some additional context on the awareness and the education piece. I've been really surprised. I've been in agriculture, honestly, my whole life, going back to being part of a family-owned dairy business growing up. And when I talk to people, whether it's farmers, whether it's people in the processing side of agriculture or renewable energy or even people on the Hill in D.C., it's not really on the radar, this market. Or if it is, there's misperceptions about it being maybe only one-sided and inflationary in terms of costs to our country of shipping. And I think what's missing in some of this awareness is just how big this market can be for renewable energy and how big that impact can be for rural economies. So just the basics of getting people to understand, you know, right now our farmers, as this audience will well know, farmers need a market. It's a tough time in the countryside, and right before us is this potential opportunity that could inject billions of dollars. So we're trying to educate. Beyond the education, then when you get to some additional incentives, if the vote passes in a couple of weeks, with certain assumptions, I would see that, you know, the U.S. will get some of the demand here, but right now other parts of the world are arguably more competitive, because they have additional stackable incentives on top of what the IMO is going to drive. And so Europe, Asia, to some extent Brazil, probably would get a lot of the market share if this thing goes through, unless we get some additional support here. But the really good news, though, is there's a couple of things that are fairly well advanced that could be very helpful in the United States. One is the 45Z production tax credit for renewable energy. If it's in the law today, the big beautiful bill that was signed this summer, but once all the details get sorted out with Treasury, DOE, and USDA, hopefully soon, that can be very helpful. And then the other piece is if there's some allowance for participation within the Renewable Fuel Standard program, some stackable incentives that could tie to that could also be very helpful. And it really could make the U.S. The most competitive market in the world for this and give us an outsized portion of the market share. So that's a piece, and we're trying to work on that, and there's some legislation in place that's emerging in the Senate around some of those pieces, and obviously 45Z continues to advance. The last piece in terms of where we need help, I mentioned infrastructure and carbon accounting. It's probably two pieces, but I'll just hit that quick. We will need additional investments in processing capacity for sure on the renewable natural gas side, possibly in biodiesel and other processing. We'll need infrastructure investment in blending and liquefaction, things that can also be good for fossil energy. And then on the accounting side, it gets quite technical quite quickly, but there's some things around how the emissions are measured and get scored, and there's some things around how accounting's done, things called mass balance versus identity preservation, and those pieces are moving along nicely, but they still got to be sorted out. So we need to continue to build awareness. We need some additional incentive, but we need some infrastructure. I'll make just one other point, Jeff, as well. The one thing, we're very involved in this sector as a company. Actually, I was just in Houston this week talking to a couple major ship owners. And when you talk to the ship community, the shipping community, which will be purchasing this fuel, one of the biggest concerns they have is there going to be enough feedstock for renewable energy? And what's really interesting about that is when you look at our country, our farmers here have supply down. I mean, they got it down and they need to market. And so we got to make these two things come together. And they're really good at growing stuff, so there's opportunity to grow and scale that, and then you get into kind of there's a competition with Food Acres, and I think you know the great news is there's a lot of egg residues and waste that don't compete against Food Acres that we can also bring into the mix. So I think we're trying to help just educate on that side as well. That man, this is an opportunity that's got to come together.
A sidebar question would suggest that sustainable aviation fuel steals the headlines. And it's clear that that would be a phenomenal increase in demand for renewable fuel. But that's not going to happen overnight, and some are questioning if it's going to happen unless Washington makes a significant investment and extends the duration of guarantees of the 45Z tax credits. But when I hear you talk about the maritime industry, at what ratio are you blending? What's required to be able to show and to verify that a company or a ship is meeting the standards that have been set by the IMO?
Yeah, no, there's a few things there, Jeff. I'll try to unpack each one. The first one is sustainable aviation fuel. It's moving, but you're right. It is probably taking up more of the headlines. Though I think it's going to take a little longer to emerge. Europe's probably a little farther along as distinct from maritime, which, could not only be here in the next 18 months, but use drop in ready now fuels that are already on the market, like biodiesel and bio LNG. So that pointing that out to people that this thing is here now and here sooner, I think is important. The other piece in terms of kind of what I think you got into what's required around blending, et cetera. There's a calculation done just as in other uses for biodiesel or bio LNG or whatever markets you're in where, for compliance, ship owners will be required to track what they use and what the emission score of that is. With a very robust set of certifications and third party verification to do it. And that gets turned in annually. And so that's how that'll all work. And maybe just for perspective as well for the audience, if this thing goes through and if some of the estimates are out that are right, this 25 million ton view of demand globally by 2030, global shipping uses about 300 million tons of fuel. So that puts you kind of just under 10%. Of all that's used. So there's still a lot of fossil energy that's still going to be in the mix here. It's just we're blending in some of the renewable to meet the program.
As I have heard, sustainable aviation fuel now is about three times the cost of the traditional petroleum product. You mentioned economic savings. Is it possible that moving to these renewable blends to meet these carbon goals, is it possible that it could save the maritime industry money in the long run?
I think, obviously some of these fuels, early days are more expensive than traditional petroleum. Now with that, long term, there's a lot of technology and innovation that'll be happening and we expect those price curves to come down. I think the other thing it absolutely does is it will drive additional efficiencies and engines that will lower the overall usage of fuel for the ship owners and can put them in a position where their costs really can be absorbed by efficiency. So there's a variety of ways around it. I think, you know, it's good to look at the bigger picture too in terms of there's a lot of waste that'll be turned into energy if this goes through. And so from a societal perspective, there's a cost to society to deal with waste and to have to deal with the outcomes of that. And so I think what it also does for society globally is it helps reduce the cost and the burden, the impact of a waste problem, because it's being valorized for better use.
Some would argue the previous administration had a finger on the scale with regard to electric vehicles. But there are industries like airlines and like maritime that batteries are just not going to work. It's going to take a liquid fuel, and certainly we can't do without those transportation means. So you would have to recognize that the potential here is real. It's just the matter of who will adhere to the rules and then who will satisfy that demand.
That's exactly right. Shipping, great example. You have, if you're a ship owner and you're going to go, you need a new ship today, or you got to retrofit a ship, you're making a capital decision that probably you need to make a bet for the next 30 years. And well, in terms of electrification of this industry, it's not there yet. It's not going to be for a while. So you're going to make a bet around combustion engines. And then with that, you're going to need other choices to decarbonize the sector. And that's the beauty of where we have things that are ready now that can be matched up against that in the form of biodiesel and bio-LNG.
So, Ben, it is the month of October, and the IMO is coming upon a decision. If they rule favorably, how quickly would this impact, or could this impact, the U.S.? And if they move in that direction, then what do you press upon Washington to provide to allow your company and others and farmers to take advantage of this opportunity?
I think the timing, if it goes through, well, the letter of the law, it starts in 27. Markets often move ahead of compliance. And, you know, we do see that there's some demand already that would like to test the system to get going as early as next calendar year. So we're in 2026, you start to see the demand start, and then it crescendos. In terms of, again, I'll go back to where we need help. One is just this broader awareness, but particularly, in governments where that there's a lot of sides to this opportunity, and to really dial in on the opportunity for rural America and not lose sight of that, so that we two can get some things across the line with 45Z that can be helpful, can look at other ways to incentivize things around some of the RFS opportunities. But three, I think, you know, because we have this big build out of infrastructure, we need capital markets to flow and work, but there's just a lot of things around deregulation, of permitting for construction and getting things built that will be very helpful. And so, our ask would be, we've got proven technologies that exist and where we can get permitting to move a bit faster. The capital flow will get set up, we'll get running. And then that just means it's the sooner we can create another market for our farmers, because the feedstock's there.
So, Ben, what happens if Washington does nothing? If they don't extend regulatory certainty over renewable fuels, if Washington doesn't invest in this new opportunity, what happens?
The market's going to be there, but it's going to go other places. You'll have Europe, Asia, and to some extent South America will ultimately have most or all of this market, and we'll be in a position where we're not competitive, or we're not capable, or both, and we're left out.
Dollars and cents, what's at stake for the nation?
For rural economies, $5 to $10 billion by 2030, in revenues, probably a bit more than that, as well, in terms of if you look at the total impact of capital inflow, capital investment to get things built. So this is a really big deal. Again, I know many of your viewers are in the farming community or agriculture, et cetera. I mean, we're talking about a market that could be 1 to 2x the size of the China export market in soybeans, or a multiple of the Iowa soybean crop. It's a big deal. And so I think, realizing that, in what's kind of a farm crisis right now, one of the worst farm economies we've had in, I don't know, modern history, that just right around the corner, is a huge solution, a market that wants the stuff that we make and produce really, really well, that if we get it right, we can really go a long way to solving a lot of problems we have in rural America.
Well, Ben Krueger, we want to thank you for taking time to be with us and to talk about this important issue as it pertains to the globe and certainly to the U.S. and for the U.S. renewable industry and ultimately for farmers. Thanks for being here. This is Open Mic, and Open Mic, if you're the guest, you get the last word.
Well, Jeff, I thanks again for your time today. I really appreciate being in front of the audience. We're excited about what's ahead. We're cautiously optimistic with a positive vote. We're very excited to be able to be part of this solution of connecting farmers to new markets in with our business at Raceline and more broadly our industry. And let's keep our fingers crossed for a good vote. And then our ask would be as well, the more you can do to help us get the word out to get ready for this opportunity and be positioned for it, we'll be better for it. So we appreciate the time today, Jeff. Thank you.
Our thanks to Ben Krueger, Senior Vice President for Raceline Renewables, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Dowling.